Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this afternoon is, to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dofano. We have one case set with this panel. Then we have a second case that's set. It's actually a reset from April 20th. With a different panel. So we'll hear the first case, then we'll recess briefly to allow the panel to change. Then the new panel will come in and hear the second case. So understand the lawyers are ready on the first case, so if you'll call the first case, we'll get started. All right, thank you very much. Ready?
May it please the court. The issue before the court today is whether or not Mr. Ferguson's reliance on his direct experience and an order of a bankruptcy court approving the application for the abandonment of property in a bankruptcy proceeding constituted reasonable inquiry for purposes of Rule 13 and Chapter 10 of the Civil Practices and Remedies Code, in light of a sanction of over $209,000 in attorney's fees that was levied against him by the trial court. The issues of bad faith and harassment that often accompany these sanctions have essentially not been addressed in the sanctions order, and we believe have been conceded by the defendant as not being present. The second issue is whether the court's failure to state with particularity the reasons for the sanctions in an order, as required by both rule and the statute, constitute reversible error for purposes of this case. It has been suggested largely by XTO, the appellee in this case, that the crux of the case is whether or not Mr. Ferguson conducted reasonable inquiry before filing suit against XTO. Now, they, generally speaking, rely upon what I would call a treatise on bankruptcy procedure, rather than delving into the rather simple assessment of whether or not, under the circumstances, Mr. Ferguson could simply rely upon a simple order that he had received and his understanding of a settlement before bringing suit. They complain, XTO that is, that as an attorney, Mr. Ferguson was in a peculiar position to understand the bankruptcy laws and to understand that under their interpretation of the law, the asset at issue, which were mineral interests in New Mexico, were still a part of his original bankruptcy estate. As an attorney, he was charged with that knowledge. And secondly, that as the debtor, he was in a peculiar position to understand that as well.
Had the trustee abandoned this asset?
Well, that's the question.
What in the record shows whether the trustee has abandoned that asset?
The record showed that the trustee subsequently reopened the bankruptcy estate after Mr. Ferguson's reliance upon the application and order, which he believed approved the abandonment of the estate, that the estate was subsequently reopened when the trustee learned of this lawsuit, and that the asset was returned to the bankruptcy estate.
Okay.
We believe that as an attorney, actually, Mr. Ferguson was in a peculiar position to read the orders that he had received from the bankruptcy court, from the trustee, and from the bankruptcy court, and from the four corners of those documents to determine that all property, including but not limited to books and records, what have you, had been abandoned to him. whether scheduled or unscheduled. And as a debtor, which is the other aspect of the Avalese case, he was actually in the peculiar position to know what had happened in the course of his bankruptcy proceedings because he knew the details of a settlement that had occurred in that case where he wrapped up everything in a global settlement. And as far as he understood, once again, all assets had been abandoned to him. Therefore, we believe that he had conducted all reasonable inquiry as necessary in order to determine whether or not he could proceed on a suit based on those assets. It is important to note that this case is not about whether or not Mr. Ferguson had standing to bring his suit. That is something that could only be determined in hindsight, in a post hoc determination. The question is whether or not he believed he had standing to pursue his suit, whether or not he made a reasonable inquiry and fulfilled the other prerequisites for sanctions, such as bad faith, harassment, or no reasonable belief that his lawsuit was grounded in law or was the basis for a reasonable extension of the law, what had you. So he had the order approving the application for the abandonment from the bankruptcy court. He also had the application itself. He had the understanding, which is in the record, that a settlement had occurred in which everything, an omnibus settlement, had allowed all assets, scheduled and unscheduled, in the bankruptcy proceeding to be abandoned to him. Even the trial court in this case found that Section 554A of the bankruptcy court.
Excuse me, I thought that the report said that only the scheduled mineral interests were deemed abandoned.
The actual application from the trustee was not so clear. It said that the trustee was applying to abandon all property, including but not limited to books and records, what have you. And this was approved by the bankruptcy court.
Ms. Slim, when the deposition of the trustee was finally taken,
sir,
and the trustee said that he never intended to abandon any unscheduled assets, and that process was a matter of subsequent review by the bankruptcy court and a determination made that the assets were not abandoned and subsequently were for sale. How can you say that your client reasonably believed that he owned those assets when he didn't schedule them in two separate bankruptcy proceedings, Chapter 11 and a Chapter 7?
Yes, because he had the final order that he had received from the bankruptcy court, and because he had participated in the settlement that had resulted in his understanding that the scheduled assets had been abandoned to him.
Okay. Were these scheduled or unscheduled?
The mineral assets at issue, located in San Juan in New Mexico, were unscheduled.
Okay, so if he believed the scheduled assets had been abandoned to him, what led him to believe the unscheduled assets had been abandoned to him?
The language of the application, his understanding of the settlement that he had
But you just said it only abandoned the scheduled assets. I'm just trying to understand what the basis of his belief was. If you're saying that only the scheduled assets were abandoned to him, what's the basis of his belief that the unscheduled ones were abandoned?
I apologize, Justice. The trustee testified that it was his intent.
Well, but that's after the fact. What does his order say?
Bankruptcy court's order?
The abandonment order.
The application for the abandonment states that the trustee is applying for permission to abandon all property, including but not limited to books and records.
And the bankruptcy judge signed off on that, right?
Yes, Justice.
Okay. And then later it was reopened.
Yes, subsequently,
there was
much later.
To recapture the property that may or may not have been abandoned by the trustee.
Right.
And then after all of that were the depositions. So do we look at the depositions or do we look at what was available before the reopening of the bankruptcy?
What we look to is the time of the filing of the lawsuit when Mr. Ferguson understood that the assets were his property or the property of another entity, Ferguson, Inc. That is a little murky.
So that was after the bankruptcy judge signed off on the application?
On the original application.
Before the reopening of the bankruptcy?
Yes.
Okay.
Just
trying to get the timeline straight here.
The timeline is awkward in this case, Your Honor. Where I was. Even the court had found that under Section 554, there was a legal 554A, Chapter 11, U.S.C. 554A, that there was a legal shelter depending on what the intent of the trustee was, so that scheduled or unscheduled assets might or might not be able to be abandoned. Whether or not the evidence ultimately proved that it was not his intent to abandon those assets, I think the existence of 554A in and of itself suggests that it may not be groundless as a matter of law to bring a lawsuit that says, I'm trying to seek whether or not a scheduled or unscheduled asset has been properly abandoned. It's a subsequent evidentiary matter, and that's exactly what the trial court did in this circumstance. The court said, okay, 554A might offer you legal protection. What I want you to do is to go back and get me the evidence so I can decide whether or not dismissal of this case is appropriate. Further, the order in this case never states, and defendant essentially concedes, that there was no bad faith or harassment. Defendant simply argues a general conclusion that there was. So what we have here, based on the general parameters of a sanctions order, is we have a belief on the part of Mr. Ferguson that his lawsuit is brought in good faith, that we have the trial court recognizing that 554A may provide legal shelter depending on subsequent evidentiary concerns, and we have no specific finding in an order or really in any response from defendants that there was, in fact, bad faith or harassment other than a general conclusion to same. I think what this is generally clear about is that this case is about a non-suit, that after the court asked for more evidence in this case, that Mr. Ferguson ultimately decided to non-suit his case. It is our position that non-suit is an absolute right, that no inference can be drawn as XTO has asserted, no circumstantial evidence can be drawn from the mere fact that he non-suited his case in order to pursue it in a different forum. And he has testified that he did so based on a claim of adverse possession, what have you. It's interesting to note that in the original sanctions order issued by the trial court, he states, Mr. Ferguson lacked standing. He non-suited his case. Therefore, he's liable for sanctions. That's about it. So the trial court was taking notice of a non-suit that should have absolutely been a non-issue. And even then, it is essential to note that XTO backed away from the idea that it was seeking sanctions for the non-suit. Mr. King said so in at least one hearing, and once again, he's to be commended for that candor. It was no proper basis for sanctions.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you. Can y'all hold it down and stop making so much noise? I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice. We would also assert that the New Mexico lawsuit that has been brought by Mr. Ferguson pursuant to his non-suit is outside this court's jurisdiction, and filing of it is subject to New Mexico laws. And if there are any sanctions to be associated with filing a lawsuit in New Mexico, that's truly up to New Mexico courts and New Mexico law.
I have a factual question. I'm just not clear from the briefs, the basis of your client's lawsuit against XTO. I mean, was it for royalties? Was it for just the basis of the underlying lawsuit.
Sure. The original lawsuit, which did morph over time into claims for damages of a more typical nature, I would say, started out as a motion to compel arbitration to determine the amount of damages he might be owed.
Damages for?
For non-payment of gas in these mineral interests contained in New Mexico.
Non-payment of royalties.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Slam, what is your position as to whether or not this court has the power to send this case back to the trial court for a further determination? I read a portion of your brief. There's at least one sentence in where you attack that position and say this court, our court, doesn't have the power to do that. I'm interested in your addressing that for a moment, if you will.
No, actually, I believe the court does have that power to remand the case, and I believe that is in there. The court does have the power to remand this case to temporarily abate this proceeding and to remand the case back down to the trial court so that we do get the particularization in an order that is required by both rule and by statute. Now, one thing I would suggest to the court that you actually have two remedies there. One would be abatement and remand. The other one might be vacature and remand. Either way, we would request that we be given the right of supplemental briefing, whether it's supplemental briefing in this court or whether it's the right to decide whether or not we want to appeal from any further fact findings that the trial court might make, because we are so left with nothing to go on in terms of the particularized conduct that Mr. Ferguson is alleged to have engaged in, that we believe it would be appropriate for us to be able to actually join those particularized issues.
Thank you,
issues.
For addressing that, counsel.
Right, thank you, Justice Meyer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Chris Cradiville from K&L Gates, and I'm here on behalf of XTO. Let me go straight away to the key question, and that's whether there was any abandonment of these assets by the bankruptcy estate. And Judge Evans, and the record before this court demonstrates that no such abandonment took place. We're here today to decide if Judge Evans abused his discretion in imposing these sanctions.
It matter whether there was an actual abandonment, an apparent abandonment that was later clarified, a question of whether there was an abandonment that was later clarified?
Your Honor, it's XTO's position that there was a 10-year pattern of misconduct by Mr. Ferguson that gave Judge Evans the discretion to impose these sanctions. And that pattern of misconduct began way back in 1999 when Mr. Ferguson repeatedly, as Justice Meyer points out, failed to disclose these assets on his bankruptcy schedules. Now, those bankruptcy schedules are prepared under penalty of perjury, and it's a debtor's foremost obligation to disclose all of their assets. If they fail to do so, as this court has held in its Kilpatrick v. Kilpatrick case in 2006, the bankruptcy system just doesn't work. Now, here, there's no suggestion, and there's never been any suggestion, that Mr. Ferguson properly disclosed these assets. I believe they've conceded that point. These assets were never disclosed, were never scheduled.
Now, by assets, are you talking about what he claimed y'all owed him or the minerals in the ground?
No, Your Honor. Well, the San Juan County mineral interests, his ownership stake, his real property interest in these oil and gas properties in San Juan County, New Mexico. And he never made the bankruptcy court, the trustee, Mr. Seidel, aware of those. As Judge Evans commented from the bench, it appeared to him, Judge Evans, this was an attempt to slip or secrete an asset by the trustee, and that's why he's been held to account.
And what authority does a state judge have to rule on federal bankruptcy matters?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's part of the overall pattern of misconduct that culminated in the improper proceedings that Mr. Ferguson initiated before Judge Evans. Now, as Mr. Slimp pointed out, Mr. Ferguson's in an unusual position here. He's both the debtor in the underlying Chapter 7 case, where he didn't make these disclosures, and he's simultaneously, at least when the lawsuit was filed, his own counsel, representing himself pro se, signing pleadings, signing the petition in Judge Evans's court. So he is simultaneously governed by two standards, two sets of obligations, the obligations that attach to any Texas attorney under Chapter 10 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code and Rule 13 of the Civil Rules, as well as the Chapter 7 debtor obligations. And then, as this court has commented in Kilpatrick, and as the Houston Court of Appeals, the 14th Court of Appeals, commented in its Locker case, it's the foremost obligation of a debtor to determine, to know what assets they have coming out of a bankruptcy.
And if there's, didn't the bankruptcy judge take care of that by reopening the bankruptcy?
Ultimately, Your Honor, but only after there was a year and a half of unnecessary and, in our view, vexatious and very expensive litigation in front of Judge Evans, all of which could have been avoided if Mr. Ferguson had simply fulfilled his obligation as both an attorney and a debtor to conduct a full inquiry before launching this lawsuit. If he had consulted with bankruptcy counsel, if he had consulted with the trustee, if he had gone to the bankruptcy court and reopened his bankruptcy, he could have established title to these assets, or at least attempted to. He did none of that. He shot first and asked questions later. He went into Judge Evans' courtroom guns blazing without ascertaining whether or not he, a recovering Chapter 7 debtor, owned these assets or not. And as it turned out, he didn't. This bankruptcy was never disclosed, Your Honor. It only came to light through the informal discovery of one of my colleagues. It wasn't disclosed in written discovery. It's something
that... Where was the bankruptcy filed?
The bankruptcy was in 1999, filed and dismissed in 2003, Your Honor.
Where was it filed?
The Northern District of Texas, Your Honor. Bankruptcy court here in the Northern District. Judge Felsenthal, I believe.
Do you agree that the sanctions can't be upheld under Rule 13 because of the requirement that sanctions under Rule 13 have to have the particulars of good cause for the sanctions set forth in the order?
I do not agree, Your Honor. You're correct that that is the general rule, but there is a specificity requirement under both Rule 13 and Chapter 10 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code for sanctions orders. But that, like any other point of error, is waivable under Rule 33.1A of the appellate rules and under this court's Bloom decision. Unless that issue is raised in the trial court, unless the trial court is alerted to the purported lack of specificity, then there's nothing to review on appeal. And here the record is devoid of any suggestion from Mr. Ferguson, any complaint that there was a lack of specificity in the sanctions order at the trial level. He never gave Judge Evans a chance to add the specificity that they now claim was lacking. About the only thing they did was file a cursory one-sentence request for findings of fact and conclusions of law, but they never filed the required notice of past due findings of fact and conclusions of law, which is, as you know, required by Rule 297 and also is required by the Supreme Court's Las Vegas Pecan decision and a host of intermediate appellate court cases, all of which say if a notice of past due findings of fact and conclusions of law is not filed, then there is no error, and that point is waived. And we think that's exactly what happened here. And as a result, any finding that is needed to support this judgment is implied. To quote the Supreme Court, the judgment must be affirmed if it can be upheld on any legal theory that finds support in the evidence. In other words, because they didn't properly complain and because they didn't preserve error on lack of specificity, this court should find that Judge Evans did not abuse his discretion if there's anything in the record that would authorize the order that he entered. And we believe that there very much is. And
so are you saying in the Bloom case that there was a total lack of any particular good cause, particular supporting the sanctions award?
Your Honor, that's how I read Bloom, and it's not just Bloom. It's a half dozen other Court of Appeals cases from this court's sister appellate courts, including the Appleton case out of Houston, the Texas-Ohio gas case out of Texarkana, the Alexander case out of the Houston 14th Court, in the McCain v. NEM Hospital case out of Dallas, and there are a lot of others. This specificity requirement, it's certainly there in Rule 13, it's certainly there in Chapter 10, but unless it's raised in the trial court, it, like any other issue, is waived for appeal. And I would invite the court to look at the record. There is no suggestion to Judge Evans that there was a lack of specificity in his orders. Moreover, because there was really only one issue before the trial court for sanctions, there was no mystery as to why Mr. Ferguson was being sanctioned. There was no confusion as to why he was being sanctioned. The only issue was this chain of misconduct that commenced with his failure to disclose these assets, continued through his failure to follow the mandate of Kilpatrick and Locker and to investigate his title, continued through his filing of a lawsuit that he either knew or should have known that he had no right to file, continued through his prosecution of that lawsuit for a year and a half after he was alerted by my colleagues to his lack of ownership of these assets. He imposed a year and a half of unnecessary and very expensive litigation on XTO based on a fiction that he knew about, or at a minimum that he should have known about, and that's the fiction that he owned these San Juan County mineral assets. As a Chapter 7 debtor, he simply didn't. Now,
Does it matter that, first of all, is it true, does it matter that there were allegedly royalty interests owing that were being paid, I guess, to no one?
That is the substance of his claim. That claim has not been explored on the merits. XTO is confident of the merits of our position. In fact, this sanctions motion, which was originally part of a motion for summary judgment, as well as a motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, XTO is very confident in the merits of its position. Mr. Ferguson has brought that claim in San Juan, New Mexico. The New Mexico court has dismissed it for want of jurisdiction. He can continue to pursue that on appeal. And
excuse me, I don't understand your answer.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Are there outstanding unpaid royalties?
No, Your Honor, not in the view of my client, no.
Well, would there be in our view?
That's an issue for the trial court on the merits if there's proper subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction and there's a court of competent jurisdiction.
Let's just say somebody owns that property and somebody owns those minerals. Whoever that somebody is, did they get paid for them?
Your Honor, respectfully, I'm not in a position to comment on the merits. And it's outside the record, I would add, as well.
Mr. Crowder, let me ask you this, then. You've asked to take judicial notice of the activities in the bankruptcy court.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it appears to me from the activities in the bankruptcy court that these assets were ultimately sold on an auction basis, supposedly for market value, brought $6,000.
Mr. Ferguson did win the auction for $6,000. There was an auction conducted by the United States Bankruptcy Court for the Northern District of Texas, and he paid $6,000 to win these assets. What he does with them now, who knows? But if he reinitiates merits litigation, of course, there's a host of additional issues.
Well,
statute
I'm not
of limitations.
About that. I was addressing the issue of what's the lawsuit been about all these years if it was a $6,000 asset?
Well, Your Honor, Justice Meyer, we certainly agree that it was a meritless lawsuit, and we fought it. We fought it hard. We prevailed on a procedural ground, but if we had to go to the merits, I think we would have prevailed on the merits as well.
I guess we're not dealing with that here today.
No, Your Honor, we're certainly not. Your Honors, I think it is important that Mr. Slimp has acknowledged that his remedy today, if this court would accept his arguments, is at best a remand to Judge Evans for crafting of the findings of fact and conclusions of law that are not in the record currently. That's his best day in this court, and I would urge the court to take a look at the Campos v. Isleta General Hospital case out of El Paso, wherein an appeal was abated and temporarily remanded for crafting of an findings of fact to support the award of sanctions and to show the award of sanctions. So I really do think that is the best that Mr. Ferguson can hope for today, and obviously we don't think he's entitled to even that, having waived the findings in fact and conclusions of law issue and the specificity issue. Moreover, there is not a case that I am aware of anywhere in the Texas system that says the specificity requirement of Rule 13 and Chapter 10 is not waivable. Mr. Slimp suggested in his reply brief that the Isleta case that I've just referenced so holds. That is not the case. In fact, if you would indulge me and allow me to quote just one sentence from the El Paso court's opinion in Isleta, that court wrote that, quote, while agreeing that the issue may be waived under Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 52A, which was the predecessor to Rule 33, we believe that the plaintiff did make some attempt to draw the trial court's attention to the need for particularized findings. In other words, the Isleta case only says that it was decided on the facts of that case and that party's attempt to invoke the specificity requirement. Here, there was no invocation of the specificity requirement, and so consistent with Bloom, Appleton, Alexander, and the rest, that issue has been waived. Unless there are any further questions from the panel, I'll yield back the balance of my time.
Any questions? Thank you. Is there a rebuttal?
Briefly, Your Honor, Your Honors, I'd like to point out that I don't think I said that the only remedy here was abatement and remand. There's also reversal and remand, and that would be the remedy that we would request. It's just within this court's power to abate and remand. It's in your discretion.
What about the argument that that's really unnecessary because the only possible basis for sanctions is the fact that your client didn't disclose these assets and apparently knew he didn't disclose them because he believed he owned them at a later time, and that's really the whole issue?
It's not in the order.
What about the waiver argument?
Which waiver argument? That he waived it by?
Right, because he didn't object to the lack of specificity.
He filed a motion for rehearing. There was a hearing that was held. The court issued an order. Mr. Stahl, who was Mr. Ferguson's former counsel, asked that the court state its reasons for its decision in writing. The court kind of said, y'all do it. You file findings of fact and conclusions of law. The Campos case, which was cited previously by my colleague, besides standing for the proposition that remand is one remedy, also stated that the requirements for an order in Rule 13 and in Chapter 10 trump the normal findings of fact and conclusions of law provisions. Ergo, it was incumbent upon the trial court to place those findings, those particularized findings, in the order rather than abnegating its authority and asking the parties to do it themselves. That's another
If that's the only basis, the only possible basis for the sanctions award, which I haven't heard you say that there's another possible basis, then the law usually doesn't require the doing of a useless act. So if we send it back down and the trial court put that in, what's the difference?
Well, first of all, you'd have to send it back down and the trial court would have to put that in, and we'd have to decide whether or not either to appeal again based upon whether it was a vacate and remand, or ask for a supplemental round of briefing if necessary, if it were a temporary abatement and remand. Either way, we believe that we're entitled to join the issue if it is finally put into an appropriate order.
So the brief that we have doesn't join the issue?
It cannot join the particularized issues that are not raised by the trial court. All we have is the letter that we got that said, you lacked standing, you non-suited. That's about it. We did the best we could under the circumstances, but this court, as well as Mr. Ferguson, is left largely to guess. And if we were to go through all the permutations of what that could or could not mean, or what facts the court did or did not rely on, it would have vastly exceeded our page limit in this case, and it would have still been a guess on our part.
But can you say that there are other possible grounds for the sanctions award, and if so, what are they?
We don't know. To tell you the truth, it may be the non-suit. That is stated quite clearly in the sanctions order, and as we've argued here today, we don't believe that non-suit was an appropriate ground. In fact, with all due respect to the trial court, we believe it may have been some irritation with the non-suit that actually resulted in the sanction at issue. Frustration at a minimum.
Thank you.
Mr. Slim, would it be understandable that the trial court was addressing in the second paragraph on the order that was signed on August 15, 2009, second paragraph saying, during the hearing, the court admitted evidence in the record and received the testimony of Scott Seidel. That paragraph, you know which one I'm talking about?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
He's citing there the testimony of the trustee in bankruptcy. That can only deal with the issue of ownership of the mineral interest. Isn't that the only thing it can be dealing with? That's why you'd be citing the testimony of Mr. Seidel?
I'm not sure about that. I think he was testifying as to his potential intent, but he was also testifying as to his non-recollection of events that may or may not have occurred. I think this cuts both ways, and that's why we would ask for the opportunity to be able to join those issues in the trial court, and if necessary, back up on appeal so that we can address those issues, show where the court may have committed reversible error. But we need to know from the trial court what it was relying on, not just simply stating that.
He
determined
that,
in hindsight.
He has to say what he was relying on. He just has to put the specific grounds for the sanctions award is what the rule says. I don't think there's any requirement that he has to say what he's relying on.
Well, if the result was no standing, then once again, I believe it was brought up, I believe, by yourself, Justice Walker, that might just be a legal conclusion, a hindsight legal conclusion. But once again, it wouldn't go to Mr. Ferguson's credibility in terms of what he believed at the time that he filed his lawsuit. And that's the kind of thing that we need to have in order. We need to have it in writing. The rules require it.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Thank you.
My name is John Stickles, and I'm here representing Damian Marcus Huckabee. I, along with Mr. Huckabee's family seating over here, are asking this court to do one of two things. First of all, to remand this case to the trial court for a hearing to determine whether Mr. Huckabee is entitled to DNA testing of four items of evidence, or to order that these four items of evidence be tested. Mr. Huckabee was convicted in 2001 of a kidnapping. For that kidnapping, he received life in prison. While in prison, he filed an appeal that was denied. He filed a PDR that was denied. He filed an application for writ of habeas corpus that was denied by the Court of Criminal Appeals without written order. And he filed pro se this Chapter 64 motion. The state, as in most of these motions, filed an answer stating, first of all, that Mr. Huckabee was not entitled to DNA testing, and second of all, that he's not even entitled to a hearing to determine whether he's entitled to DNA testing. Past 4 or 5 years, I've done many of these cases. And unfortunately, The result at this stage in all of these cases is virtually the same. The state says he's not entitled to the testing, and we don't even want to have a hearing to determine whether the defendant is entitled to testing. For the life of me, I can't figure out all these years why the state does this. There's only three possible things that can happen if the DNA is tested. One of them is he's confirmed to be guilty. The other one is it's inconclusive. And the third thing is that he would not have been convicted had this DNA been found. None of these things are bad. We're asking this court to have a hearing, to do one of two things, to either remand this case for a hearing to determine whether Mr. Huckabee is entitled to testing, or to order these four items tested. Mr. Huckabee has met the requirements under Chapter 64 to prove DNA testing in this case. Identity was an issue. There was no physical evidence connecting Mr. Huckabee to this crime. He was convicted based on co-conspirator testimony and one or two witnesses who testified to various items that don't really constitute the crime. He was convicted entirely based upon co-conspirator testimony. Under the applicable cases, particularly the Blacklock case, this puts identity in issue. In addition, Mr. Huckabee has vigorously denied since the day he was arrested of any complicity in this crime. There are four items of evidence, two cuttings from a sofa, two cuttings from a sweater, that we believe are available for testing, and that if tested, if they come back the right way, would prove that Mr. Huckabee did not have anything to do with this crime.
Was the sofa in the apartment where the victim lived, or the victim's estranged wife?
It was in the sofa was in the apartment where the victim lived. Okay. And there was some blood on the sofa. And we're requesting that the blood on the sofa be tested. And there's two different cuttings from the sofa that contain blood. Where also there was a sweater found in the trunk of Mr. Huckabee's automobile. We're asking, and there was blood on that sweater. We're asking that cuttings from that sweater, which was available, would be tested. If those come back in the affirmative, we believe that that would be evidence to show that Mr. Huckabee did not commit this crime. And based upon this new evidence, there's a 51% chance that he would not have been convicted. The state, in their response to this brief, says that there's just no evidence to show that, first of all, Mr. Huckabee is entitled to testing, and second of all, if he's entitled to testing, that it would have made any difference in trial. The reason there's no evidence to show that is the trial court did not have a hearing on Mr. Huckabee's Chapter 64 motion. It's basically circular reasoning for the state to file an answer saying, we don't need a hearing on this case. And then if it's appealed to say, well, since there wasn't a hearing, there's not enough evidence. We believe this court has the authority in this case of first impression in the second court to say, we want hearings on these Chapter 64 motions. We don't want to be...
But counsel, isn't that set by statute? I mean, don't we have to follow the statute?
Yes, ma'am. And we have met, that's exactly right, Your Honor. We have met the requirements under the statute to have a hearing to determine whether Mr. Huckabee is entitled to testing on his Chapter 64 motion. We believe the court erred in denying his hearing.
Mr. Tickles?
Yes, sir.
Your briefing at page 6 states that the sweater was mentioned but not admitted during the applicant's trial.
Yes, sir.
And so there was no evidence about any DNA or DNA testing or any DNA that might have been on the sweater that was part of the trial.
Yes, sir, that's right.
How about the sofa? I didn't see anything in your brief about the blood or the DNA that was supposed to be on the fabric from the sofa cushions. Was that admitted, the sofa cushions, or was there testimony in the trial court about the DNA on the sofa cushion?
There was testimony about the DNA on the sofa cushion that was talked about during the trial. The testing, I believe, the DNA testing on the sofa cushion was, the results of that were mixed at best. It may or may not have been attributable to the defendant, or it may not have been, may or may not have been attributable to other persons. That's why we're requesting more intensive or more current testing on the sofa.
Yeah, well, I'm asking you about what was presented in evidence trial about the blood or the DNA on the sofa. Was that tied to Mr. Huckabee or not?
No, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. And in conclusion, Your Honor, even though I haven't argued very long, this case is important because it deals with the convicted person's right under the statute to DNA testing. In this case, as in virtually all of these cases, the defendant has filed a request for DNA testing. The state has filed an answer saying we don't want testing. The trial court said no testing, and here we are. We're asking guidance from this court in both in this case and in future cases as to the procedures to be used for granting DNA testing.
I have a question. The state says that a hearing is not required unless the court, or a hearing is required only if the court orders DNA testing and the testing results are complete. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, I do not agree with that. I believe the court has authority under the Chapter 64 to have a hearing to determine whether or not DNA testing is needed.
Okay. At a hearing for DNA testing, to determine whether DNA testing should be ordered, is the defendant entitled to, or the convicted person entitled to, expert testimony?
I believe if there is a hearing ordered, that would be, naturally, I think that would be one of the requirements, to bring testimony to show whether there is current DNA testing available, what it could be used for in this case, and things like that. Those are the types of facts that could be developed at a hearing.
That newer techniques may be available?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Love?
May it please the court, counsel. First of all, I'd like to correct something I believe you asked, Justice Meyer. I do believe from my recollection that there was blood connected to appellant on the couch fiber found in the victim's apartment.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Appellant has not shown that he wouldn't have been convicted if DNA results were exculpatory by preponderance of the evidence. Even if testing showed the absence of Parker's DNA or appellant's DNA, or even the presence of a third party's DNA on the sweater, other evidence supported that Parker had been in the trunk of the car. It wasn't just the sweater that tied him to that. Specifically, human blood matching Parker's DNA profile was found on the weather stripping in the trunk, and an eyewitness placed him there. So that evidence is not significant. Likewise, the absence of his DNA on Parker's couch wouldn't have proven that he hadn't been in Parker's apartment because witness testimony also placed him in the apartment.
Okay, what eyewitness placed Parker in the trunk?
The co-conspirator, I believe his name was Brown. And I've got the cites to that in my brief.
Yeah, okay.
And moreover, as set out in detail in my brief, it starts page 14. There's a huge list of other evidence that supported that appellant was involved in Parker's kidnapping and murder, evidence that had nothing to do with the sweater or the couch. And a good bit of that evidence was not from the co-conspirator. It was from other sources. We had police officers involved. We had people who saw appellant show up before and after the murder to get the sheet that they ended up wrapping the body in, showed up after the fact. The timeline's there. He gave misinformation to the police about where he was, very specifically timeline, which was disproven by other witnesses. It's not just based on co-conspirator's testimony. As far as the hearing goes, appellant has a statutory right to a hearing only if the court orders DNA testing and the testing results are complete. I've cited some cases in my brief, Cepeda v. State. It's an Amarillo case citing Whitaker. And I think it's pretty well settled in the cases I've read that he's not entitled to hearing at this point. And unless there are any questions, I'll conclude and ask that this court affirm the decision of the trial court below.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Ms.
Thank you.
rebuttal?
Very good. State points on page 14 of their brief to other evidence that tends to connect applicant to this crime. If you look at all of this other evidence, it is testimony from co-conspirators, co-defendants, person that was called to testify who they say quit the conspiracy. This is the type of evidence that gives rise to these type of wrongful convictions. Testimony that is not supported by any type of evidence that connects the defendant to the crime. These are the type of cases that Chapter 64 was intended to redress. And we're asking this court to either order DNA testing or remand this case for an evidentiary hearing.
What about the state's argument that even if the DNA were tested again and found to be negative, not his DNA, that would still not establish by preponderance the evidence that he was innocent?
Yes, Your Honor, that's very easy to stand up and say, well, even if the DNA came back the way we want it to, it's not going to make any difference because we have all this other evidence. But we don't know how the DNA, if the DNA test would come back the right way in favor of Mr. Huckabee. We do not know how that would interact with other witnesses' testimony. We don't know how the jury would consider that. Things like DNA evidence that backs up defendant's story are very powerful to the jury. And in the face of these so-called eyewitness testimonies and co-conspirators' testimonies, who are basically the only thing that connects him to the crime, the DNA evidence would be highly suasive. And I don't think anybody can stand up here and say, well, it's not going to make any difference. You know, DNA doesn't matter. If it comes back the way Mr. Huckabee wants it to, it's not going to be persuasive. That doesn't make any sense. If the DNA comes back the way we want it to, we believe there's a 51% chance he would not be convicted.
That would be because the sweater didn't connect Mr. Huckabee with the car and the trunk of the car.
That's one possible outcome, yes, sir.
And it could be that the blood on the sofa did not have a connection to Mr. Huckabee.
Or could be explained away, yes, Your Honor.
And if both of those things happened, what would be the circumstance in terms of all of the other testimony that the state outlines on starting on page 14?
That other testimony we would believe would be discredited because it would be in the face of scientific forensic evidence that the jury could hold and put their hands around in deciding this case.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to understand is, was there a position taken by the state in Mr. Huckabee's trial that the DNA evidence of the sofa connected him to the crime? If there was not, then proof that the DNA on the sofa was not his would not have had any effect on what was presented in the trial court. I mean, it would have at least some arguably less effect than 51%. And since we had no DNA evidence about the sweater, I'm hard felt to understand why, if there was no evidence of Mr. Huckabee's connection to the sweater, that it would be persuasive in his defense in a new trial.
I understand your question, Justice Meyer. I think those are very good questions. Unfortunately, we don't know the answer to those because the trial court chose not to have an evidentiary hearing. These are the type of issues that can be explored on the evidentiary hearing. And we can stand up here and speculate all day long about what might happen. If we had a hearing to determine whether or not Mr. Huckabee receives DNA testing, those type of questions could be answered.
Thank you, sir. I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, both counsel, for your very good arguments and on a very difficult issue on which there's not very much law. We appreciate your help, and your case is submitted. And you'll be hearing from the court shortly. Thank you.